Cardiff Garcia.
Stacey Vanek Smith.
Do you hear this?
Yeah, I know. It's the holiday music for the holiday season,
yes,
which means it's time to ask for money. It's the giving season. It's the giving season is what I meant.
We are asking you to donate to your local NPR member station because they bring so much wonderful programming to you.
That's right. And by going to donate.npr.org/indicator, make sure you include the /indicator.
Yeah, because then they'll know we sent you.
That's right.
And we will deliver that love right back to you.
So please make sure to donate before the end of the year.
And thanks again.
NPR.
Hey everyone, it is Cardiff and Stacey. The Indicator is taking a week off, but we'll be back with all new episodes next Monday, December 30th.
However, while we will not actually be working, we are still going to focus on work. We're going to revisit some of our favorite stories about one topic that we talk about a lot on the show.
Yeah, we're not giving our listeners a break. We might take a break.
No, no break. No break for you guys.
That's right. We might even bust out the air horn for Jobs Friday. Who knows? Who knows?
Exactly. Basically, all this week, we are going to revisit stories about a topic that we talked about a lot this year on the show, the labor market. We are calling the series The Work Week, and we're going to cover everything from gender segregation to whether the unemployment rate is really to be trusted. Our first episode up originally aired in February of this year. Back in 1937, General Motors signed the very first contract with the United Auto Workers Union. It was the culmination of weeks of drama. GM did not want its workers to unionize, so workers staged a sit-in strike inside the GM factory. Production ground to a halt.
An historic strike began when GM workers barricaded themselves in the automobile assembly plants for 44 days. They provided their own entertainment, slept in and ate in, while the work stoppage cost GM $1 million a day.
Officials did try everything to stop the strike. They even turned off the heat in the factory. And remember, this is winter in Michigan.
At one point, a riot broke out, and this standoff was just captivating the world.
What observers describe as the most crucial battle in American labor history, involving nearly 100,000 men, has practically shut down the entire American motor industry. From Michigan, where the strike started, we bring you these actual pictures of a riot in progress. What happens when a crowd of strikers grows crazy? When destruction becomes the order of the day?
In the end, though, GM's CEO signed a contract with the United Auto Workers Union.
And that handshake means the strike that shook a nation is over.
Labor and the auto industry would never be the same. Chrysler and Ford followed suit, signing union agreements of their own. This is The Indicator from Planet Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Cardiff Garcia. Today on the show, what this major union victory meant for workers, what it meant for the auto industry, and why unions over time kind of lost their mojo.
After 6 long weeks of idleness, it's home today and back to work tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor State Farm. Why do you need State Farm renter's insurance? Because it helps protect the stuff landlords don't, like your furniture that gets drenched by a broken pipe. State Farm Renters Insurance. Find an agent or get a quote at statefarm.com. Support also comes from Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
That moment when the auto industry shook hands with the union, U.S. business was forever changed.
Without question, a historic milestone.
Harley Shaken is a labor economist at Berkeley.
That modest contract, one page, was labor's Magna Carta.
In the decades after that contract was signed, the UAW bargained for things like pensions and healthcare benefits and paid vacation and famously high salaries. That's according to Gary Bertless, an economist with the Brookings Institution.
U.S. auto workers were among the princes of industrial labor in the United States. They received very high wages, very good fringe benefits.
A union job became a ticket to the middle class, and those high union wages spread out across the economy. People had more purchasing power, the U.S. economy grew, companies got wealthier, more of them unionized, unions were riding high, and everybody wanted to be a union worker.
Yeah, more and more workers started up unions in their industries. Unions spread across the country, and by the mid-1950s, more than a third of all U.S. workers were in a union. That is today's Indicator more than a third.
And then the oil crisis descended. It was the early 1970s, gas prices spiked, and suddenly everybody wanted a small, fuel-efficient car. U.S. automakers were not so good with the small, fuel-efficient cars. And foreign competitors like Volkswagen and Toyota started to get a foothold in the U.S. market, a market that the big three U.S. automakers had just totally owned before then.
And consequently, the big three lost a lot of sales, lost a lot of profitability, and without those huge profits, Ford, GM, and Chrysler just could not afford to pay such outsized wages to their workers.
Suddenly, Americans were actually buying a lot of foreign cars, and those foreign cars cost less, partially because they weren't dealing with the high salaries and benefits that the big three were dealing with. The good deals that unions had negotiated when times were good started to drag on U.S. automakers.
Manufacturers and their unions could not turn on a dime. They couldn't change the arrangements.
Oh, they were less nimble in a way.
Yes, exactly. They were less nimble in responding to the demands of the market.
After that, labor in the U.S. just kind of lost its mojo all over the country, says Gary. And this happened for a couple of reasons. First, companies across the U.S. watched this thing unfold in the auto sector, and they thought, we don't want to deal with that. They started fighting unionization like never before, sometimes intimidating workers or firing workers who tried to unionize, even though that was not legal, and also lobbying hard against unions, pushing through legislation to weaken them.
Companies in all kinds of industries were also seeing more competition from overseas, just like the automakers had experienced. And companies were starting to equate unions with an inability to compete.
And so they fought unions much, much harder, using much stronger methods, some would say coercive methods.
At the same time, says Gary, workers themselves started to back away from unions and from trying to organize employees in the companies they worked for. This happened both because companies could be so vicious to workers who tried to unionize, and also because in some cases, unions were seen as cumbersome to workers with these sort of onerous regulations that would just drag a company down.
Industry in the United States is very dynamic. We always have companies that are growing, expanding, becoming more profitable. And at the same time, we have businesses like Sears, whose operating model has proven to be less successful. And it happens that in a lot of the shrinking industries, unions have been very important. And businesses have been much more fierce in resisting unionization than their counterparts were in the 1950s and 60s, when it was very plain that unions and very successful unions in many growing industries were not an impediment to companies being very successful and expanding. But nowadays, I think in many workers' minds and in many businessmen's minds, the notion that you would be both unionized and growing and flourishing seemed to be incompatible.
Politically, in the time after the oil crisis, the way people and companies saw unions had just shifted. Today, says Gary, there are more retired members of the United Auto Workers than working members.
Right now, the labor market is strong. The unemployment rate is low, and companies are having to compete for workers. That gives workers more leverage to do things like unionize. Still, says Gary, that is just not happening at the rate you might expect. In fact, last year, union membership dipped to its lowest level since that contract was signed between the UAW and GM in the 30s. According to the Labor Department, just over 10% of U.S. workers are unionized. And in fact, Cardiff, we should probably say that you and I are both in a union.
Yeah, full disclosure.
Yeah, so a lot of workers at NPR are in SAG-AFTRA.
And cue the old-timey audio.
This episode was originally produced by Darius Rafieyan. The Update was produced by Lena Sonsgiri. Our intern is Nadia Lewis. Our editor is Patty Hirsch. And The Indicator is a production of NPR.